Will your church be one of the issues, etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues, etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues, etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues, etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues, etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Last half hour of today's program on this Tuesday afternoon, the 18th of May. We're going to spend it with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, a journalist in Washington, D.C., contributor to GetReligion.org, and author of a recent column for Christianity Today titled Same-Sex, Different Marriage, and a column for the Wall Street Journal titled Pass the Plate, Grow Rich in Spirit. We're going to talk with her about two issues, same-sex open marriages and tithing. Now, you can join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address is talkback@issuesetc.org. Molly, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
I'm glad to be here.
The slogans, the buzzwords of the proponents of same-sex marriage for several years now have been monogamous, lifelong, committed. What have you recently discovered about some of the proponents of same-sex marriage and what they plan for post-same-sex marriage in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure how much of it is recently discovered, because actually there's been a lot of discussion about what how monogamy is understood differently by certain gay partnered couples. And that's been out for years. What's new is that the mainstream media took notice of it recently. So this year, the New York Times actually had a story talking about how perhaps gay relationships could point the way to the salvation of marriage for all people. And so they looked at this study of gay couples in San Francisco, and it showed that half of these relationships in this study were open. And what that meant is that the partners consented to each member having sexual relations outside of the union of the two. And the New York Times said that the prevalence of this in the gay community could rewrite the traditional rules of matrimony by showing straight couples that monogamy doesn't need to be a central feature of marriage, and that sexually open relationships might point the way for the survival of the institution. So it was interesting, mostly, that the New York Times had covered this. This is actually something that's well covered in the gay press, and it's something that, you know, gay activists who have written about it, people like Andrew Sullivan, have always been quite open about open relationships and their prevalence in the gay community. But it's something that's sort of not talked about by many in the mainstream media.
Okay, a couple things to respond to there. First of all, the presumption or the assumption on the part of the New York Times is that traditional marriage and monogamy somehow need to be saved from themselves.
Right. Well, you know, I think of how funny it is that, you know, decades ago when divorce laws were being loosened, you had advocates of traditional marriage saying that this could really harm the institution, and they, of course, were painted as horrible people who wanted women to suffer in bad marriages and whatnot. And now what you're seeing is actually that those laws, whatever benefit they might have had for women or men who were in very bad marriages, that it actually has weakened the institution of marriage, and that the institution is sort of on rough ground right now. That the New York Times would think the way to make it better would be to turn to open relationships is, you know, surprising. Or maybe not surprising. I certainly don't agree with them on that front. But there is a truth that marriage as an institution has been hurt over the past few decades.
The other thing that occurs to me, we're coming up on our 23rd wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
You and Mark have been married how long?
Just under 4 years.
Okay, so 4 years. I'm sure that Mark has probably learned even before you guys tied the knot, that you expected monogamy. And I'm sure he expects the same of you. I cannot imagine how my marriage would survive if we even entertained the possibility of opening it up to other people.
Right. Well, I mean, we could talk about all the rules that are a feature of open relationships and the different rules that people talk about. But what I'm mostly interested in, and the way I sort of started looking into this, is trying to understand what marriage means. So when the debate about whether to extend the institution of marriage to same-sex couples began, I started looking into the arguments for why marriage is constructed the way it is. And you never read about this again in the mainstream media, but obviously marriage is about procreation and children. That's why the institution is universal. It's existed across all time, continents, cultures, religions. Marriage, monogamy is because of the centrality of procreation and children. Monogamy is a central feature of marriage because women and children would suffer, of course, if they didn't know who their father was, and if men had multiple responsibilities to multiple families. And so it's a sort of rational thing that monogamy is a central feature. Now, when you have no risk of procreation, and obviously we're talking about for the norm, with homosexual relationships, there's no risk of procreation. So it's somewhat irrational to expect monogamy as a central feature like it would be for people in heterosexual relationships, even apart from whatever religious or psychological reasons they might have for favoring monogamy.
As you look at this, what do you think the presumption about traditional marriage seems to be, either by the proponents of same-sex marriage or by those like those writing in the New York Times, who say that we need to save marriage from monogamy?
Right. Well, that's again what I wish people were thinking about more as we debate whether to broaden the institution to include same-sex couples or other arrangements, which certain activists who want same-sex marriage also want, other arrangements included, such as polyamorous or polygamous, relationships and whatnot. But basically, the traditional view of marriage would be the conjugal view, the idea that marriage is the union of a man and a woman who have a permanent and exclusive commitment to each other that's naturally fulfilled by children, that, you consummate that marriage through conjugal acts that serve, that would work toward having children, and that that leads to norms of monogamy and fidelity. The other view of marriage, which is sort of the one adopted by the mainstream media and much of the culture right now, is that that marriage is a union of any two people, that they should commit to romantically loving each other, that they should care for each other, and it's a union of hearts and minds rather than bodies. And the state should recognize that because it's nice that straight people can have that too. So, they don't have a reason for not having homosexual partnerships within the state's recognition of marriage. Those are two radically different views about what marriage is, and they have consequences throughout the culture. And, one of the failures I think that the media have had recently is to not explain what these two views are and how they have consequences beyond their definition.
Do you think there's even a grasp of how radically different these two? I mean, this isn't just about how you view marriage. This goes to how you view society. Marriage is kind of a foundation for all the institutions in society. I mean, it is far-reaching. Do you think there's a grasp of that in the media today?
I don't think so. I mean, it was interesting. One of the Washington Post hired a guy recently to report on conservatives and the Tea Party movement. Now, he's not a conservative himself, although they think he is, I guess. But he had written recently that he empathized with everyone he covered except for the bigots who oppose traditional marriage or who oppose same-sex marriage, and that he has no empathy for them. Well, obviously this didn't go over well, and he had to apologize shortly thereafter. But I thought, well, he's just saying what everyone else in the newsroom thinks. And I've never really met a reporter who's given much thought to why marriage exists as it does, why it has throughout all time and history been a heterosexual arrangement. Even if you have, polygamy, it's always been a heterosexual arrangement. It's not like the wives are married to each other. It's that they're all, it's sort of like they're in serial heterosexual relationships, and is there a reason for this? It's like they haven't thought it through. There's not enough respect probably for traditions and history as it is in newsrooms, and they really think only as insofar as, hey, I have gay friends, I'd like them to be able to get married. The only possible reason that you wouldn't want that is if you're bigoted, and that's pretty much as far as they've thought it through.
Joe is listening in his car. Joe, thanks for waiting on the line.
Hi, I have to take issue with you in a sense. You said that marriage is historical, transcultural, et cetera, I would also have to insert that the abuses of marriage have been there from the very beginning. Every writing, ancient, as far back as you can go, has abuses of marriage included in it, including the Bible, obviously. Another thing that I think about this is, why is the state even involved in marriage? I mean, there is only one legal reason why the state is involved in marriage now. I'm not saying that it has always been this way, but it has to do with the disposition of property of one of the people of the marriage. That's the only purpose for the state to be involved. Otherwise, it should be a religious thing. I would take a libertarian approach. I don't even think the state should be involved at all with it. So.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much for your call. Let's begin a response, and then we'll pick it up on the other side of the break, Molly. About 30 seconds to begin a response to Joe.
Well, I might actually kind of agree that there are differences between how the church should treat marriage and how the state may or may not treat marriage, but it's not necessarily true that the only interest the state has, particularly now, in marriage is, you know, for dispersion of property. Marriage is an institution that predates government. It's something that has existed prior to the establishment of governments. It's a foundational institution for society. It has to do with, you know, rearing of children into good citizens. It has to do with you know, protection of women and children. It has so many features that the state, you know, if the state were to completely get out of it, and as a libertarian myself, I've, you know, thought a lot about this too, you know, there would be quite a few entanglements there too.
All right. When we come back, we'll get more from Molly Ziegler-Hemingway in response to Joe's call. I want to pick up something she said as well, and that is often lost in the shuffle here, whether it was no-fault divorce, which kind of is a philosophical precursor to what's being discussed today, often lost in the shuffle, are children. And maybe they envision a future where marriage has nothing to do with them. We'll be right back. But I've got two lovers and I ain't ashamed. Two lovers and I love them both the same. Let me tell you about my other lover. In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
Lutheran Radio in Exile. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Bridgeton, Missouri. Calvary Lutheran, Elgin, Illinois. Advent Lutheran, Zionsville, Indiana. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas. Holy Cross Lutheran, Albany, Oregon. St. John's Lutheran, Evanston, Indiana. Mount Calvary Lutheran, San Antonio, Texas. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Boise, Idaho. Village Lutheran, Ladue, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa. St. Paul Lutheran, Clarinda, Iowa. Trinity Lutheran, Lebanon, Missouri. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Excelsior Springs, Missouri. The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Freeburg, Illinois. And Peace Lutheran, Neenah, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Support, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is our guest. We're talking about same-sex open marriages. In just a minute, we'll turn to the subject of tithing. She's written recently about that. in the Wall Street Journal, an article titled "Pass the Plate, Grow Rich in Spirit." I wanted to pick up on something you said in response to Joe's call with one more question on that, Molly. You mentioned protection of children, and it seems to me that that would be a natural interest that the state ought to have, protecting children within, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, which is always the ideal, with parents, with homes, with protection from all sorts of exploitation that human history is rife with. Talk about that, if you would.
Right. Well, again, you know, the reason why I think it's important for people to think about how they're changing marriage law, or if they want to change marriage law, you know, looking at what the consequences are. If your marriage culture sort of changes, now we've seen it change with recent passages of laws permitting divorce more easily and whatnot, it affects the stability of the family. And when you think about how much money the federal government spends, or how many programs it's involved in, almost all of the social spending is related to the breakup of the family. You look at how, as the family has trouble, the state comes in, and as the state comes in, it leads to, you know, more trouble with the family. But you know, everything from drug abuse, teen pregnancy, school failures, you know, mental problems, a lot of these are related to the breakup of the family or due to family fragmentation. So the state, you know, can argue that it has an interest in making sure that marriages are stable and secure, because it just costs society so much when they're not.
Molly, you've also written recently about tithing. The big story at the end of the year, of course, that you talk about in your Wall Street Journal article was none other than Saddleback running almost $1 million short at the end of December, and the last time to pass the plate for them didn't help their situation. What happened after that, and what did you discover about tithing among America's religious?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. Rick Warren sent out a plea at the end of the year. He'd never done this before, announcing that they were $900,000 in the red for 2009, and asked the congregation to contribute funds. And there was a study that showed that 40% of congregations in various denominations cited a decline in giving last year. And, you know, that makes sense, because a lot of people give relative to their income, and people are not faring as well economically. But it's just interesting to see, you know, how tithing has changed over the years. And even though there's a pretty stable group of tithers in the country, it's only like 7% of churchgoers who tithe, or 7% of the country, I should say, I think it is, who tithe. And that has stayed stable over the years, but it's a sort of surprisingly low number, I think, of people who are giving 10% of their income to the church.
One of the things you wrote about that I found surprising was that people, generally speaking, people of lower income tend to tithe at a higher rate than people of higher income.
Yeah, it was something like 11% of people who make, you know, who are really poor, like making under $20,000 a year, tithe, versus 9% of people of families that make over $75,000 a year. So it has nothing to do with one's wealth, and it probably has a lot to do with your habits. I'd recently read this great book by a former colleague of mine named Doug LeBlanc, and it's all about the ancient spiritual practice of tithing. And he just talks with a bunch of different people who tithe as part of their spiritual discipline. And it's interesting to me how many have done it, you know, forever, or since they first got married. You know, they just made a decision and they stuck with it. So when times were good or times were bad, they just kept contributing to their church 10% of their income. And that's why they call it a discipline, probably. It's something that you need, you know, you need practice at. You need to teach your children how to do it from a young age, which is funny, because when we give our daughter money to put in the plate, she joyfully puts it in and then is sad that it's gone. So I think we need to work with her on what it means to contribute the offering.
Well, you also made reference to the very late 16th century, perhaps on into the 17th century, Council of Trent, the Roman Catholic Church, said tithe or else. I mean, they made it part of canon law, and that's a very rare view, at least officially, nowadays among Christians in America.
Well, and thankfully so, I think. I mean, they would excommunicate people who weren't tithing, and they had better abilities to monitor people during that time, I think, with some of the economic systems that were in place. But, yeah, I mean, as a Lutheran, I'm very happy that we, you know, we teach that you should contribute, but it's not a, you know, it's not a 10% requirement or whatnot. And interestingly enough, I didn't have any recent data. I tried to get some recent data, but just a couple years ago, Lutherans actually had a surprisingly high percentage of people who tithe, people who give at least 10% of their income. And the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod was particularly high, with 15% of its membership reporting that they tithe regularly, again, compared to some of these lower rates nationwide.
So how do you think that squares with what is not unique to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the church body of which we are both members, but of mainline denominations kind of across the board? They, at least their funding for their national headquarters or national efforts are languishing. I mean, they are shriveling up and dying on the vine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a different story. I think you'd have to really break it down and look at each church body, because, again, in some situations, the actual members of the denominations are giving more than they've ever given, but they're just not sending it to national headquarters because they don't agree with the direction that the national denomination is going, and they would rather target their funding. So if you have a church body that isn't funding missionaries, isn't funding seminaries, isn't funding, you know, things that the people really want to focus on, and instead they're funding, you know, bureaucracies and they don't really know what they're doing, you're going to withhold more of your funding from the national church body, and you're going to direct it directly to the seminary or to the missionary programs that you want to see flourish. And in other cases, you have mainline denominations that are just hemorrhaging members and have for decades, and so, of course, their giving is down. And then you have other church bodies that have, you know, really strict requirements on tithing, so even like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which requires a 10% tithe. I don't know what their figures are, but I'd imagine that since it's a, you know, it's a requirement, I'm sure that, you know, their members are fulfilling that requirement, you know, as best as they're able. So you just see variations across the board.
Then, with only about 30 seconds, how did the story with Saddleback come out? Did they make it through that year?
They needed $900,000, and they got $2.4 million.
So it didn't hurt to ask, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
You can read both of the columns that Molly Ziegler Hemingway have been talking about with us in the last half hour. In Christianity Today, Same Sex, Different Marriage, and for the Wall Street Journal, Pass the Plate, Grow Rich in Spirit, at our website, issuesetc.org. Molly Ziegler Hemingway is a journalist in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to getreligion.org. Molly, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks again.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we'll talk to Molly's husband, Mark Hemingway, of the Washington Examiner, about Super Tuesday's election. It kind of came and went, but it actually did happen. There were a lot of elections today, and we'll get a retrospective, one-day retrospective, on them with Mark Hemingway tomorrow on Issues, Etc. You know what I discovered? I discovered that Christians are the most generous people in all the world. Bill Gates, other great philanthropists, Warren Buffett, they give away a lot of money. They do, for various reasons. I think some philanthropic and some in their own interest. They're generous people. Oprah Winfrey, she just throws it around, doesn't it? She calls it paying it forward. It's kind of strange. But Christians, ordinary people sitting in the pew every day who don't make the hundreds of millions, who don't have endless, bottomless buckets of money or deep pockets from which to give. Now, do they give as everyone would like to see them give? Not necessarily all the time. But when the need arises and when they are aware of a need, they do. That Christians are truly generous. There is a generous spirit at work among Christians. Now, I look at myself and I say, my spirit is not generous. I don't have a generous spirit. My spirit, the one I carry around that I was born with as a son of Adam, is a hoarding spirit. Very ungenerous, very ungiving, wants to keep everything for myself. But the principle that God lays before us as Christians, led by His Spirit, is that everything has come to us as gift. There is nothing we have that we have deserved or earned. All that we have You name it. The stuff in your closet, the stuff in your garage, the stuff in your house, the clothes you wear, everything in your life, including and most importantly, the salvation that was won for you by Jesus Christ, all comes free. Absolutely free. No strings attached. No payments required. No fine print to worry about. So as we have been freely given to by this gracious God through Jesus Christ, guess what? Christians led by that same God, that same Spirit of God, actually give. They give away. We have a giving God, and He produces in us, in spite of ourselves, in spite of our selfishness and our desire to hoard all that we have and all that we have been given, He moves us, Christians, in spite of ourselves, to be giving like He is giving. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow, and thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.